Good afternoon and welcome to the Budget Subcommittee for Department of Natural Resources for the House Finance Committee. Today is February 20th and we will have a presentation on the Land Disposal Income Fund, and we'd like to welcome Deputy Commissioner Ed Fogles to the table, and also I think you'll be joined eventually by Marty Parsons, who's the Deputy Director for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. And I am Representative Costello, and welcome, Ed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ed Fogles. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. Today, we're going to give you a presentation on some of the fiscal issues around our land disposal program. Marty Parsons.
We've been joined by Representative Feige.
Our Deputy Director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, Marty Parsons, will do the bulk of the presentation, as this is his area of responsibility within the division. But just to set the stage, I'll give you just a little bit of background. Many years ago in my career, I was the manager of the land disposal program in the mid-1990s. And the program had been dormant for many years before I came on board, mostly because we had disposed of so much land that the system sort of kind of imploded, and there were too many demands on the administration of our program to really keep administering it effectively. So we basically had to sort of pull back and not offer much land for a number of years. So then we resurrected the program, and we looked for new ways to sell the land that was a little more efficient. And I think we've done that, and subsequent teams have really restructured and done a good job of improving the land disposal program. It's still a very expensive program to run. It costs money to sell land, and it's getting more difficult as the years go on. We have less land available. We're giving land to municipalities. In addition, there are more people out there, more competing uses. There have been at least three land disposal projects that have come across my desk since I took this job a couple of years ago, and all three of them have been very controversial, and we've sort of put pauses on all of them to try and work out some issues. But it's part of our mandate. We do think it's important to get more land into private ownership, so we are looking for ways to continue to do that program, and this fiscal part of it is a very important part of it, and I think that it'd be really good for this committee to understand some of the nuts and bolts behind that. So I guess with that, I'd like to turn it over to Marty Parsons for the presentation.
Before you get away without any questions, could you just describe the basic philosophy of the fund? I mean, what is the money intended for, improvements? And if so, could you give us some examples?
Yeah, I mean, basically the intent of the fund is primarily to run the program itself, right? We have staff on board that have to go out and find the land and design a project, go through the public process, and then once that first phase is done, there are a number of phases to the land sale program. Once the land is sort of the project has been sort of pre-cleared through a best interest finding, then the staff have to design a subdivision. Their survey costs, their appraisal costs, their disposal costs for holding an auction. So all that is funded by the Land Disposal Income Fund. There are other parts of DNR that have been funded through that fund over the years that may be not so directly related to land disposals, and those we've slowly been peeling out of that fund and replacing with general funds. But again, the general intent is to the income from the land sales is to go back into this fund to fund the program itself.
And we've been joined by Representative Foster. Are there any guidelines that to prevent the department from accessing the fund for other uses? What's the best way to protect it?
No, you're getting into the realm where either Marty or Gene Davis ought to come up. But I believe that the legislature has to appropriate our budget from various funds, so it's up to them to decide, what comes out of the fund and what doesn't. So, but again, that can be drilled down into more detail in Marty's presentation.
Thank you. But welcome, Marty.
Good Good afternoon, Madam Chairman.
Good afternoon.
For the record, my name is Marty Parsons. I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. And the LDIF, the Land Sales Program, is part of my responsibility. So I was here last year. This will be an update for what we went through last year. Many of the slides are the same, but a lot of them have some updated information. We'll not only talk a little bit about the land disposal fund, but we'll also talk about some of the effects of the economy and how it's affected our ability to sell land and what we see in the future and how that might turn around. Make this work. There we go. Many will wonder, why is the state in the land disposal business in the first place? If we look at the Constitution, Article 8, Section 9 tells us that we're to promote the settlement of the land, and that we're to provide for sales and grants of land. We provide sales through the land disposal program, and of course through the municipal entitlement program, where we grant lands to the different municipalities based on the lands available within their boundaries. And in 2000, the legislature believed that this was an important enough responsibility of the division that they set up the Land Disposal Income Fund, which is basically set up, as Deputy Commissioner Fogel said, to administer the program and to sell land. One of the side benefits of our program is that we also create quite a bit of private sector jobs, as we have continued to sell land into the organized boroughs. They've put more and more stipulations as far as road construction, utilities that need to be placed before we can get those subdivisions through the platting process. So in essence, we create private sector jobs through the sales of these subdivisions. It was determined that it was necessity to convert the program from a hit and miss program into something that was much more consistent. There have been fits and starts. We've had disposal programs that have gone back to the 70s, where we basically had a stake it yourself, go out, find a lake, have your family stake five or six different parcels around the lake, and that was a little bit unorganized. And so as we've worked our way through the process, we've determined that there has to be a more responsible, more organized method for us to sell land.
We've been joined by Representative Pruitt.
Some of the things that we look at when we sell land: we have settlement, which would be your subdivision sales. We have recreational programs, which is what we call the remote recreational cabin stake it yourself program, and then of course agriculture is part of our disposal process as well. One of the things that we have found recently is that the projections, if we look at basically the income that we received and the expenses that we've had to incur lately, that shows that the LDIF cannot sustain itself. Right now our costs are increasing, whether it happens to be in personal services or whether it's in the construction projects that we need to take on to get our plats approved so that we can go ahead and sell the land. This graph indicates what I was just talking about. You can see that for a while we had a pretty close relationship. As the revenue went up, the income went up as well, which is the income is basically the revenue we receive less the expenses that the program incurs. But as we get past about 2006, you can see that a lot of additional expenses were going against the land disposal program, against the fund. A lot of that had to do, again, with the organized borough saying that, no, you can't just put a small road in. You have to build roads to the standards that we've established for our borough. And without getting those roads in place, the platting authority won't approve our plats, and we can't sell the land. This has also happened with our remote recreational cabin staking program, where some of the organized boroughs have said it doesn't count that you say you can get roads out there, or there's generally allowed uses across state land. We want to see that you have determined that they can get a four-wheeler out there, they can get some type of access to it. So it has increased our expenses. I think one of the things you'll notice in the graph is in 2011 we have a little bit of an uptick in the income, and basically that has been the result of some of the management programs that we put into place to try to sustain the fund. This graph shows a balance of the fund as we project it through the end of the year. The bright yellow line down through the graph is basically where we are making projections forward. What we've seen from July to December are our actuals, and the December through July are projections, and basically we've just looked at what we would estimate the total year income to be and just projected that out through the rest of the year. That doesn't mean that there might be other incomes or revenue sources that come in if we are able to get some of the delinquent contracts brought up to speed, then we can increase that balance at the end. But right now, we're projecting the fund will have about an $800,000 balance at the end of the current fiscal year. We've tried to list out some of the reasons that we're seeing the decline. Last year, when we were here, we talked about oil and gas and OPMP having certain appropriations against the fund. There are three other organizations that we're looking at this year with the admin services, IRM, and the PIC.
Marty, do you mind, just for those listening online?
Sure.
I know what OPMP is. I don't know what RIM or PIC is. So halfway there.
The PIC is the public information.
Office. Center. Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And IRM is basically our technical services. And OPMP is the Office of Project Management and Permitting. So one of the things we've looked at, we try to dissect our program and determine what's happening and why are we seeing a reduction in the LDIF. And as you can see from this slide, that we've dropped from 441 parcels in FY08 to 103 parcels in FY12 sold over the counter. We're seeing a little bit of a reduction in the participation in our auctions. Fortunately, our defaults are down. In FY12, we had 184 this year so far. In FY13, we're down to 104 defaults. As I mentioned before, we've had increased costs regarding road construction and utilities that need to be put into place. All sorts of contractual services that we need to put these, especially the subdivisions, up for sale are increasing. Our survey costs are going up, appraisals, the higher fuel costs, as we've seen over the last month or so, gas has gone up considerable, and all of that affects what our contractors charge us to go out and prepare to prepare our subdivisions. It's a little history of the operating appropriations that we've had over the years. No reason to go into a lot of detail on this. But you can see as we've gone through, we have had some fairly significant appropriations from the fund to other areas besides directly involved in the offering and the preparation of land sales. One of the things that we've looked at and have tried to manage is our capital expenditures coming out of the fund. Every year we bring forth a request for a CIP, capital improvement projects. Right now we've appropriated $10.4 million in capital improvement projects. Last year we spent around $600,000. While the funds are appropriated, if we were to spend up to what we needed, we would crash the fund, and that's not our intent. So one of the ways we manage and protect the fund is to limit the amount of capital improvement projects that we do and that burden on the fund. As we get into a look at what's happening in the economy of Alaska, I talked to some people I've worked with in the past at Northern Economics. They pulled up some information from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And this kind of tells a story of what the folks are doing out in Alaska. They're what I'll call retrenching. They're solidifying their positions. They're paying down debt. They're not incurring new debt. They're trying to improve their position. So there hasn't been as much expense on, shall I say, frivolous or discretionary items that there have been in the past. People are more worried about making the mortgage and keeping heat in the house and having a little bit set aside for a rainy day. We've looked at what the workforce dynamics are out in Alaska. Right now, your top five employers are Providence Hospital, Walmart, Cars Safeway, Fred Meyers, and Arctic Slope Regional Corporation Energy Services. We've looked at some of the I guess, more common occupations that are involved in those in those top five employers. As you'll notice, the wages are between the $40,000 to $30,000 range, which most families, that means there's at least two people or one and a half people working. We really don't see a fairly significant increase in the wage rates until we get to the pump operators up on the slope as far as the oil field services. The estimate that we have right now is the discretionary income for most families is about $1,000 a month. So it's one of those things that during this particular economic downturn that we've seen, we have seen that the land sales have basically followed the economy as people retrench and pay more attention to taking care of their assets. They don't go out and invest in some of the larger or bigger ticket items that they might have. But we think there's some good news on the horizon. We've got some fairly large projects. We like to call them game changers that are out there that you can see the state starting to see a turnaround in those wages that are being earned and the people that would be more involved and interested in not only subdivision land sales but remote parcels. We're looking at Donlin Gold and the project out by Bethel and the gas pipeline project that'll go along with that. Of course, the in-state natural gas pipeline, Chewitna Coal, the Pebble project, Live and Good has a large gold project up there. All of those things are the type of projects that start to increase the average wage rate, and it also increases the pressure around existing communities for subdivision land and the number of people that want to go out and recreate in the state and have a piece of the state of Alaska. So as we see these projects come along, we're fairly confident you'll see a greater demand on the land disposal program for people to purchase parcels. We've looked at several solutions on how to defend the fund. As I've talked about, we've reduced our capital spending, which is one way to protect the fund, but it is not necessarily a good way to prepare yourself for the upturn in the economy so that you have more parcels available to sell. We're requesting in the governor's request in his budget that we move the three organizations that we talked about, admin services, informational resources management, and the public information center out from underneath the LDIF and make that general fund. And we're also spending a lot more time observing, looking, and managing our processes that we use to develop subdivisions and land offerings. This is not my favorite graph in the presentation, but this shows basically the two lines indicate if we do nothing, if we leave status quo, do not follow the governor's proposed budget, we wind up with the fund going upside down to the tune of about $828,000. If we use the governor's budget, we're still at a negative of 273, but that number is manageable. There are things that we can do to manage that number so that it doesn't dip below zero. Some of those things are we leave positions open a little bit longer before we recruit to fill them. We again manage how we use the LDIF for capital projects, and if we're successful in some of our offerings that will come out in June and July, then there's an opportunity to increase revenue, and all of those things potentially bump up that number closer to zero. I think is one piece of information that we gleaned out of our analysis is we've brought almost $300,000 back into the fund just by contacting individuals who have been delinquent in their payments, and they brought themselves up to current. So that's been a significant increase in the LDIF, and we continue to do that. That's an ongoing process that we contact those folks, try to get them current so that the land doesn't lapse, even though we have another opportunity to sell it. but it gets those funds back into the program. This is a list of ideas on how we intend to sustain the fund, the governor's budget, attempting to increase the over-the-counter. We do that by going to sportsman shows, places to make them more aware of the lands that are available, and that you don't have to be a lottery winner. You just simply go online, pick out the parcel you want, give us a credit card number, and the land is yours. Or get into a land sales contract, however you prefer to do it. We've also looked at some new types of land sales that we haven't done in the past. One of the things that we see changing a little bit in Alaska is the demographics. The people who live here, a lot of folks like the idea of going out and staking their own parcel, and they're out in the middle of nowhere and they've got all this land to themselves. But they find that once they really get involved in it, it's very difficult. It's very expensive. And so what happens is they get an allotment, they go out, they start to stake it, it never gets to a lease, the lease never gets to a purchase, basically nothing happens with that land. So we're looking at ideas where we can potentially build some primitive type access, a hardened four-wheeler trail, something into an area that we can use more of a remote subdivision type feel, that a lot of the work is done. And there's not quite as much work on the participants' part to get to a parcel that they can purchase. One of the things that we discussed last year, and Representative Feige had asked me whether we needed any statutory changes to initiate this project, is to sell larger parcels to developers. And we do not. It's something we can do. We have chosen not to, just because we didn't want to be in competition with private landowners by selling large parcels. But as we look at the program, these large parcels, especially adjacent to municipalities, it sometimes is better to allow the developer to take on the risk of getting through the planning authority, building all the roads, putting in the utilities, as opposed to the state trying to manage how we sell those lands so that we don't flood the market and wait until we've sold the 40th or 50th parcel to recoup all of that money we've put into the infrastructure. So that's an idea that we're toying with. It's not something that we've come to a firm decision, but it is a way for us to get land out into people's hands without the state incurring all of the costs to do all the infrastructure work. This is what we have in the pipeline. There are several projects that you'll see that are suspended for various different reasons. South Central has four remote recreational cabins suspended, primarily because of problems getting through the planning authority in the Mat-Su borough. Northern Region has 8 subdivisions that are delayed. These are subdivisions where almost all of the work has been done except for the layout and survey. But because of the 10-mile wide corridor that currently exists for the pipeline, we're not incurring any inhibitors to the development of the pipeline. So until we know exactly where that corridor goes, where that actual 1-mile corridor, we've suspended any sales within that 10-mile swath that exists today. Once that corridor is established, then those all come back online, and we're able to get those back on the market. And Southeast is a smaller project area, but we find that the land sales that we have in Southeast are probably our most profitable of any of the sales in the state. We've come up with basically 3 options as we go forward that we could use to stabilize the fund if we determine that after the governor's budget goes through, we get the 3 other organizations out from under the LDIF. If we need additional funding, these are 3 ways that we could do it. The first way would just simply be go through the list of personal services, determine everybody whose salaries are coming out of the LDIF, roll them under the general fund, and then just use the LDIF for nothing but capital projects. That would be one way to stabilize it. We could do more of a scalpel in looking at only those people who are not directly involved. That would be an appraiser that may sometimes work on LDIF, but primarily works on pipeline projects to determine rental rates, pull all of those people who are not directly involved in the land sales, roll those over to general fund, and that would be about a $2 million savings to the program. One of the other items that we've looked at is we can take the $10 million that we have in appropriated capital projects. We rolled those out from under the LDIF and made those general fund. Then that would allow us to increase our capital projects so we could get more roads, more utilities, more of these proposed subdivision sales out and onto the market, as opposed to using small $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 projects a year. That would for a short period of time, probably a five-year period, maybe six, take the pressure of that $10 million off the LDIF. And our recommendation is not to pick any one of these, but to go through on a very methodical, step-by-step. If the governor's budget passes, then we'll monitor that and see how it affects our ability to continue to stabilize the LDIF. If not, we would propose that the $10 million be rolled into general fund so that we could more aggressively produce subdivisions in the areas closer to the municipalities and get those out for sale, and then look at option two, and then finally option one, but not to do it all at once, not to choose any one of these, but allow the market to recover, do what we need to stabilize the LDIF in the short term, and continue to increase our sales so that we don't have to come back and do some of the more aggressive options. We're taking several steps to straighten the pipe so that we don't have as many redundancies and as many let's call them bureaucratic hang-ups to get these projects out and onto the street. One of the things that we have done most recently is we used to have, if you look at the organization chart, you had a group that did land sales, subdivisions, and a group that did remote rec staking. Well, a lot of the work that they did was the same work, and you had two different groups doing exactly the same thing twice. So what we did was we broke that barrier down. We call them silos of excellence. We knocked those down, and we combined those into one project group that now works on all land disposals for the South Central region. They determine what projects they're given a list of objectives and what they want to accomplish. And then it's up to them to come back and show us what they've done, what combination of different projects they've pulled together. So far, we're seeing that the group is starting to form. They're working on projects, and it looks like that has the potential to be very successful. And if it is, we'll implement that same type of project management style elsewhere. As I've mentioned, we're working on those delinquent land sales contracts. One of the things we can also do a better job is how we stage our projects so that we are only building the road necessary for that particular section of the subdivision that sold, as opposed to spreading out the sales throughout the entire subdivision area, block it out and build through the first section, and once those are sold and we bring the next section, then do the capital improvement necessary to get the lots on the back side of the subdivision ready for sale. And as I had mentioned before, some of this more primitive access, hardened trails, that will be a capital project, but it's not the extensive capital project to get where you're having to build blacktop roads and put in utilities. In summary, we view the LDIF just not as a fund to continue to keep state employees working. It's a fund used to provide a consistent supply of land to the people of the state of Alaska so that we can fulfill our constitutional mandates of settling the land and making those programs available. We're convinced that this is a temporary economic slowdown. We've got too many projects in the in the hopper that we honestly believe will turn this into a higher demand for our subdivisions. As many of you know, in many cases on the private sector and manufacturing, Ford being a good example, when there's a downturn, you don't necessarily stop production. That's a good time to make investments so that you're prepared when the economy turns around, you're ready to hit the market and benefit from that return. We know that the housing market is cyclical. We're mirroring so much of the rest of the country's economy that as the economy turned down, we slowed down in our sales. We think as the economy continues to grow, as these game changers, we call them, come on online, we'll be in a really good position to help Alaskans realize, you know, their hopes and dreams of owning a piece of our state. That's our presentation.
Any questions from committee members? Representative Pruitt.
Real quick one would be related to the auction. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed that also that the amount, the final sales amounts have also decreased with the decline in the economy?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, all of our auction sales, we of course determined through our appraisal group a minimum bid, and that's what our fair market value is. We have sold nothing at or really near that minimum bid. We've received, those people who are participating are I won't say a premium, but they're paying for full market value plus for those parcels. What we're really seeing is a decrease in the number of people who are participating at this point.
So we're still selling the same amount of parcel. I mean, most of the parcels that we would on average, I guess, because it's hard to. I know every parcel is different, but we're still probably getting the same amount of parcels sold. The difference is there's just not as many people that are being a part of that transaction.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, no, we are seeing a reduction in the number of parcels because we're seeing a reduction in the number of people. If we had 175 people participating, we would have sold 175 parcels at or above that appraised market value. Now we might be seeing 105, 110 people participating. So we're still seeing the market value plus. What we're not seeing is the number of people participating in the auctions.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you considered simply lowering the price?
Representative Feige, through the chair,
could you make more revenue, not necessarily dollars per acre, but total revenue by lowering the price and selling more parcels?
Representative Feige, through the chair, we cannot sell below market value. Statute does not allow us to sell below market value, so when our appraisals come through, that sets the floor as to what we can sell those parcels for.
Okay. Is there any possibility the market appraisal is too high?
Representative Feige, through the chair, I would say no, and the reason I would say that is from what we've seen in the auctions, when the auctions take place, sometimes we'll sell for 1.5 up to twice what the appraisal price is, depending on the lot. So our appraisals are relatively conservative, and so I don't think we're that far over the market. I honestly believe it's just a number of participants. It's the over-the-counters where we've seen the major drop-off. And again, those are at the appraised value. There's no bonus bid in that you would get in an auction. I think it's just a matter of right now we're not seeing the number of people participating.
In the cases where you've found that you've had to stall projects because of local or just impediments, I would mm-hmm. just call them. Does the state have, I mean, since it's in our Constitution to make land available to residents of Alaska, do we have any legal footing for pursuing, you know, continuing those projects through, I don't know, other means than simply, I mean, to me it sounds like you hit a hurdle and then give up, for lack of a better way to describe it. But I just was wondering, seems like there's a state interest and responsibility, constitutional responsibility, to get land to the people. So how do you resolve that?
Madam Chair, it's not that we give up. It's that we go back. If a community is set against us having a land disposal, and they say, well, we have enough land disposals, we don't want any more people living here, well, the infrastructure won't support it, then we continue to dialogue with that community. We may set that project off to the side, but we continue to work it. We go back to the community and talk about how do we change the plan that we originally came up with to make something that more fits into what the community's desires might be. One of the areas we've looked at is a relatively large block that there may be an opportunity for us to go back and have a regular subdivision sale close to the road, which would make sense, and then do this hybrid project that we're talking about with these remote subdivisions for the back end of the project, so that we don't get the density of lots that the community was originally concerned about. So it's not that we stop at that point. It's we go back and look at it and say, okay, what are the concerns of the community? Can we work with the community to get what they need, but continue to move our projects forward? There's nothing that says we couldn't just go forward with the project. Normally what happens at that point is we hear that, you know, through representation that we're not listening to the community's concerns. So we try to work very, very hard to incorporate all of that into our final design and before we go forward with the project.
And when the fund was set up, was it intended that administrative costs would come out of that appropriation? Or is that something you've learned was not the best idea over time?
Actually, the administrative part was supposed to come out of the fund. What's happened is the capital projects and the expense that has gone into the construction of roads and putting into utilities is where we've seen the real increase in our costs. When the LDIF was first established, we would do what was basically called a paper plat. And you'd have a subdivision drawn out. Here's where the roads are. The roads normally did not get constructed. There was an access, four-wheelers went through there, but there was no real construction work that went into it. As some of the boroughs have matured, they've said, well, that just leaves the burden on the borough to come back later and put roads into your subdivision when the people demand it. So we're not going to approve your plats until you actually do the road construction to our standards. So what normally we might have put in, gone from no roads to a single lane gravel road, has now become a two lane blacktop road with ditches and all the other accoutrements that go along with a collector or whatever established road standards those boroughs have.
And do you work at all with Commerce on, I mean, they are tied into the communities and they have a arm of marketing the state. I mean, have you ever worked with across departments to publicize this program or communicate to communities?
We have not worked directly with Commerce. Commerce is part of the folks that we talk to and make aware of the different projects that we have going forward. Primarily, we have done our brochures that go out to Alaskans. We do the websites. We go to the sportsman shows where we have a booth that allows people to see where the different over-the-counter items are and make them aware of our auctions. We do a small amount of advertising to make sure that people know that the auctions are coming out, but we have not really engaged Commerce per se as a partner to advertise or to drum up business.
And then I have Representative Pruitt, do you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question. I want to go back to the discussion on the roads.
Mm-hmm.
So help me understand, because I was thinking most of the land that you guys are selling is land that, like you said, you can look on there and there's a road plotted in there, mm-hmm. but the likelihood is it's a four-wheeler trail or it's not really something that's improved.
Mm-hmm.
Where are these locations that you are having to actually build the full road? I mean, are these in organized boroughs? Are we seeing it in unorganized areas as well, where certain towns or communities that may not be organized are asking you to do this? And if so, I mean that's a pretty substantial. That makes sense why your fund is depleting. If you're building roads up to standard in some of these areas and basically supplementing what a developer would essentially do, and the cost would be spread over the cost of purchasing the home or whatever development when that developer then goes to sell it. We are supplementing a developer is what it sounds like, and in some senses.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, that's a good synopsis basically of what we do. And it's in the organized boroughs where they have their own platting authority, and since we can't move forward until we get approval from that platting authority, if they say the borough standards is two lanes, 16 feet wide, so much of a shoulder, ditches on either side, drainage structures, all those types of things, we have to put the roads in based on those borough standards. Some of the boroughs have recently gone through multiple rewrites of their ordinances, and they've worked with where it was a little more lenient, and the state could put in a one lane road that got access to the main parcel. Now they're saying that if you have a parcel back here and the closest road is a mile away, you have to build the road to our standards all the way back to your parcel, not just within your parcel. So that is an area where we've seen some significant cost increases, and the fund, honestly, in 2000, I wasn't here when the fund was reinvigorated, but from what we've seen, it never anticipated those types of costs against the fund.
Sure, Representative Pruitt.
This is fascinating. I mean, this was not something that I had learned in the 2 years before when we had talked about this fund and knew that it was. Maybe we talked about it. I had just missed this. This is a substantial cost to the state as well as a cost to this particular fund. Does it reflect then on the market value that we're getting in the land that potentially is going to be sold?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, yes, it does. We are able to recoup those costs as part of our land sales program. But one of the things that we look at, the state, because it is the state and doesn't necessarily work on a profit margin, we try not to flood an area with lots so that we depress the market for land within a borough or an area. So if we have 50 lots that we have accessed through our road construction into a subdivision, we may only sell 10, 15, 20 of those. Well, we recoup that portion of the road construction that lot represented, but until we sell the last lot over which we had the entire construction project amortized, we don't recoup all of our costs.
So do we end up... Madam Chair, we do end up recouping the cost, but it could be over the course of multiple years.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, that is correct, and you have a cost of money associated with that investment that you made before you recoup your final dollars.
So then, can I one other question related to that: the market value that's placed on that particular subdivision, when we have someone come in and determine the market value, are they determining it that one time and for that whole subdivision, we're not going to have someone come back in and determine that market value again? That's going to be over the course of 5 years or whatever it takes us to sell that subdivision. The initial stated market value by that appraiser will be what we will continue to place as the market value on all of those parcels. Or do we have each year someone come in and determine the market value of what we're about to sell? Because I could imagine a scenario where we initially, because of the of course the road came in, we determined that a lot was $10,000, and then 5 years later we're finally selling, and at that point it could be at a higher value. How do we handle the appraisal aspect of it?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, we do reappraise lots. In fact, one of the processes that we're going through right now is lots that have either been turned back over to the state or have been out on the over the counter for over 5 years. We go back and look at those and say, has the value of these lots increased? And then we would take that new appraised value as a selling price. we would look at the same thing. We only appraise the lots that we're selling as part of a sale for that year. So if we're only selling 20 lots, then we appraise those 20. Then if the next, maybe the next year or the next 5 years, we sell 10 more, we would look at the appraisal price to reflect the current market value.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Feige? No. Is there a better way to consider management of the fund? I mean, in terms of some of the demands and the overlap, perhaps, with you know, other functions, even of the legislature? I mean, seems like we here in this body, we determine through a process, you know, what roads we want to support with capital funds, and that is a huge process in itself. But then you're off doing something separate, which is somewhat related to this, but it all deals with access, really. And so is there a better way to go about this type of process where perhaps the management is done more inclusively with different types of input?
Madam Chair, we do that to a certain extent. Forestry, for example, in the Tok area, there's a biomass project up there. And one of the areas that's a prime area for the harvest the biomass for production of electrical generation is in one of our subdivision areas. So we work with forestry, where forestry will actually put in some of the initial roads to access, and then we improve upon those to get to the final standards. So in that way, both divisions benefit. We benefit from the roads. Forestry, of course, gets the biomass. We get the land cleared without an expense to the state to do that. So we do work where possible to cross between sections of DNR to try to gain some of those efficiencies so we do reduce our costs.
Any other questions for Marty? Well, thank you, Marty. Appreciate you coming before the committee. Again, if there's any questions that you think of later, just let us know. Our next meeting, we will be hearing an AGEA update and overview and an overview of the oil and gas arbitration. So with that, thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.